Okay, good evening, everybody. This is Debbie Yobbs from the CJD Foundation. Thank you for being with us this evening. I'm very pleased to have with us Eric Minnickel from the Broad Institute. He is co-founder of Prion Alliance and a frequent blogger on cureffi.org, which I'm sure many of you have read. And I'm sure you've all also heard about his recently released paper, Quantifying Prion Disease Penetrance, here to hear more about tonight. And he will be interviewed by Dr. Lee, who is co-director of the National Prion Disease Pathology Surveillance Center and is our co-medical director. So at that, Dr. Appleby, I'll let you pose some questions to Eric.
Good evening. So it's really my pleasure to talk with Eric tonight about his work and also just his story. And I would like to just start off with the fact that I think many times when people first hear the story about Eric and Sonia, they kind of think of the typical citizen scientist type story. And I would caution you that this very much is not that. And hopefully you'll get an impression of why that's not so. Eric and Sonia really have become very serious scientists and are doing very important work in the field of prion disease, especially genetics. And one of the things that they've done in that process is really tie a lot of people together. They've been very collaborative in their efforts, and I think that many people in the field have really. So, Eric, why don't we just start off? Can you tell us a little bit about your and Sonia's story and what got you into this?
Sure, absolutely. So, unfortunately, my mother-in-law got sick in 2010. So my wife, Sonia, and I had just gotten married a few months earlier in 2009. And then in 2010, my mother-in-law got sick, and it was a diagnostic odyssey that'll be familiar to a lot of people on the call. Went to a lot of different neurologists at a lot of really excellent hospitals and couldn't figure out what was wrong. Ended up, dying undiagnosed. The possibility of suspected prion disease had been raised, but we didn't have a definitive diagnosis. We found out only from autopsy that she had died of a genetic prion disease. And that was pretty surprising to us because there had been no family history of dementia. On either side of her family, no one had died of an illness even remotely similar to this. But it turned out that Sonia's mother had a genetic variant, and that meant that Sonia, my wife, was at 50-50 risk. We immediately made a decision to get tested. I think for us it was we had to know. We're just that type of personality. It's different for everyone. And we found out that my wife does have the variant that her mom had. And after that, we initially embarked on just trying to understand more about what this meant for us, and it quickly snowballed into, embarking on a quest to become scientists and do research on these diseases. I guess that's what brings us here today, in a nutshell.
So tell us a little bit about what you're doing, where you are, and I know you're in the training process. Can you kind of catch us up to date on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I guess it's been about 4 years that Sonia and I have been working on retraining ourselves. We started out by taking night school, and then, eventually we were able to quit our jobs, and we got kind of entry-level jobs in a neurodegenerative disease research lab at Mass General Hospital. We did that for a couple of years. Fall 2014, so about a year and a half ago, we enrolled as PhD students at Harvard Medical School. So we're, PhD students in biology. It's a research degree, so there's a little bit of taking classes at the beginning, but mostly it's just doing research for about 5 years. And the research lab that we ended up joining is located at the Broad Institute, which is a joint research institute between Harvard and MIT that uses genomics and small molecule chemical screening and a lot of different sort of new approaches to try to understand and hopefully eventually develop therapeutics for diseases such as prion disease.
And you're in Daniel MacArthur's lab currently, is that right?
Yeah, I'm a little bit weird in that I um, I kind of have two affiliations. So I worked in a lab supervised by a guy named Daniel MacArthur before I started grad school, and it's been such a valuable experience. It's been a great place for mentorship and so on. That lab basically does genetics of rare diseases, which has, you know, just been perfect with, you know, some of my interests. So I've continued to work a little bit with that lab, even as for our PhD research, Sonia and I have both officially joined Schreiber's lab, which is a lab that studies chemical biology, so basically trying to find new small molecule drugs for difficult targets like prion protein. So I kind of wear two different hats right now.
Obviously, I have a very interesting perspective coming into the field, not only not having a science background to begin with, but also having the personal experience as well. Is there anything that surprised you at all, or anything that you think would be interesting for other family members to know now that kind of you're also a researcher and being involved in the field? Have you learned anything new or anything surprised you about that?
Oh, you know, so many things. I could probably spend this whole call just talking about that, but I'll try to limit it to a couple of things. One thing that I've really gained perspective on over the, you know, these 4 years of going from patient to patient and scientist, is, you know, just getting a sense of the timeline of science. I think working in this field, you know, week to week, it's easy to look back on what you accomplished in 1 week and be really frustrated by it. I think, you know, at the ground level, science just moves really slowly. But at the same time, when you look back at larger time increments, if you look back and compare where science is now to where it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, it's actually, it's, you know, it still surprises me every day just how far we've come. So I think, you know, we as humans have a tendency to overestimate what we can do in the short term and underestimate what we can do in the long term. And I think that's absolutely true in science. So I've, you know, the question that I get most often from people on my blog and stuff is, you know, when is there going to be a treatment for these diseases? And, you know, I guess the only answer I can give is we don't know, but I think it's, for me, it's hard to be an optimist about the very short term. You know, I don't think there's anything in the pipeline that's going to turn into a drug this year or next year or the year after. But when I look at the longer term, like the next 10, 20, 30 years, I think that it's incredible what progress is being made, and I'm definitely an optimist. The other thing I'll say is that when we first started getting into science and, you know, we were coming in at the ground level, not knowing anything, just asking a lot of questions of scientists who were much busier than us, and a lot of what we heard was frustrating in that people won't give you a straight answer. So, you know, if you ask a scientist something, a lot of times they won't say yes or no. They'll say, well, the evidence suggests that blank, or some people think blank, or we suspect that maybe blank, or they'll say, you know, there isn't any evidence that blank, and that's kind of their way of saying no. And that really frustrated me at first because I just wanted people to give me a straight answer. But I've, you know, sort of to my own chagrin, over these 4 years, I've started talking that way too. And the reason I've made that transition is I've realized there genuinely are a lot of things that sound really basic that you would think somebody should know that we actually don't know for sure. And so that sort of conservative language of just saying, well, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, or here's what the evidence suggests, but we don't know for sure, is kind of the safest way to talk about it. And, you know, it'll probably be frustrating, but I'll probably use that language a couple of times on this call as well.
Yeah, I heard a joke for the first time today about what NASA really stands for. Never a straight answer. I think that's point that you're approaching. And it's true, and unfortunately a lot of it is in the inherent nature that there's a lot that we don't know, and a lot of times when we answer a question, it actually brings up more questions. So I think you're somewhat similar in your situation as I was when I started out in the field of prion diseases. There really wasn't anyone in my institution that was doing it, so I kind of had to do a lot of kind of self-teaching and seeking out people outside the institution. So can you tell us a little bit about what you learned when you started prion disease itself and kind of how that went, especially where you are?
Sorry, I think there was a beep as someone joined. I didn't catch all of the question. Just how we learned about prion disease, or?
Yeah, like, so you did an overview about how science how entering science was interesting and how you were surprised by multiple things. Is there anything particular about the field of prion disease that you were surprised to learn about, or that kind of caught you off guard, or was maybe a happy surprise?
Yeah, I mean, you know, actually I'll say that there's been a lot of happy surprises. I think, you know, one thing that I'm really grateful for is if you have to have, you know, a rare and horrifying disease, at least have an interesting one. And prion diseases are really interesting, and we're lucky for that because it means that they're shockingly well studied for how rare they are. I mean, you know, a lot of diseases this rare, you know, if we were to come in today and realize we had the disease and we wanted to become the big advocate for this and build the scientific community, we'd be starting from scratch. Whereas, you know, Sonia and I came into prion disease in, you know, beginning of 2012, and there's just a huge research community, thousands of papers, there's an annual conference, you know, there's CJD Foundation, there's just, you know, there's a ton of resources for these diseases. So that's something that I'm really grateful for. Something that my perspective has changed on a little bit, I actually slightly regret naming my blog curefi.org. I think when we first started out, you know, what we were told, and I think this is the way most people hear it from their doctor, is, well, you know, you have a disease called fatal familial insomnia, or you have a disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And, you know, come to find out, these are just, you know, those are names that were given before we knew what the cause of these diseases was. And I think, in truth, now that we know, you know, the molecular side of these diseases, it would be better to just call them all prion disease. But it's hard to, you know, once you've gotten used to using a name, it's hard to change it. That's my story. I'm sure that's the story of CJD Foundation too. But I do think it's important to remember that, you know, we're all in this together. Prion diseases are one, you know, they're one group, and I try not to use the names for the, you know, individual subtypes as often.
Good point. So do you want to talk a little bit about your recent paper that came out? Just to kind of give a little bit of background to family members. You know, about 10 to 15% of cases of prion disease are genetic in origin, meaning it's due to a genetic mutation. But there are a lot of different things that can happen in a gene. And sometimes there can be some variants that can cause the disease, but sometimes there are some variants that don't cause the disease. Sometimes the disease-causing variants will cause disease in everyone, sometimes not in everyone. And your paper really does a good job at trying to answer some of those questions. So can you take us through it a little bit?
Sure, yeah. So I guess to start with, we should just kind of make sure that we're square on some of the terminology that we're using. So I jumped in using the word variant, and you're using it too. So just to be clear, you know, I guess the background here is that, you know, we 15 years ago when the Human Genome Project happened, you know, that was basically they sequenced the DNA of, you know, it was actually a few different people mixed together, but let's say it's one person. I mean, basically, the human genome that we know is basically just the genome of one person who happens to be the reference that we compare everyone else to. And so when we say a variant, we just mean, you know, any place in your genome that happens to be different from that person. So where that person has an A, you have a C or something, or a T or a G. And if we look at, you know, if we look at all the protein coding genes in one person's DNA, there's about 20,000 of those genes. And if we look across all of those, you know, the average person is going to have somewhere on the order of 10 to 15,000 variants. So saying that someone has a variant, you know, in and of itself doesn't mean a lot. We all have tons of places where we differ genetically from, you know, some random person who happens to be the reference genome. So, you know, the question is, are individual variants associated with disease? And, you know, traditionally the way we've thought of prion diseases is that they're dominant, which means that they're variants that cause the disease. And, you know, dominant as opposed to recessive just means that you only need one copy of that variant to get the disease. You need two copies, one from both parents. And, you know, I'll get into the details in a second, but, you know, a little bit of what we found in this study is slightly blurring that in the sense that, you know, sometimes there can be one variant that causes the disease and is, you know, just about sufficient to give you the disease. And there can also be variants that might increase your risk of disease but, you know, do not guarantee that you'll get the disease. So I guess those are just some of the terms. So as far as explaining what we found, you know, I'll start it with sort of the person who motivated this, and you can tell me to hurry up if I'm getting into too much detail here. But basically, after we got Sonia's genetic test report, our first question was, does this mean that she's definitely going to get the disease? You know, she'd been at 50-50 risk. Now we know she has this variant. Does that mean she's at 100% risk, or, you know, is it not quite 100%? Is it not deterministic that you'll definitely get the disease? And, you know, we asked around, and some people told us, well, there's, you know, we've seen a few people who had this variant who lived until they were 80 and then died of something else. So it's not quite 100%, but maybe 95%. But there was something that still bothered us about sort of, as we started reading more of the science behind this, there was something that wasn't quite satisfying about the way that people had concluded that that her variant was very high risk for prion disease, which is that the way that people found these variants was they went out, looked for families where a ton of people had prion disease, and then they sequenced DNA in those families until they found a variant that all the people who got sick have. And then when we wanted to know, does the variant always cause the disease, they turn around and say, well, everyone we've seen with this variant has the disease, therefore it causes it 100% of the time. Which is kind of circular reasoning, right? So the way you find the families is that they have a disease, and then you ask, do people in these families have a disease? So our question was basically, how do we know that there aren't other people walking around out there in the world who have the same variant that my wife has, but never get sick? And the way we thought to try to ask this question is, well, we know that prion diseases are rare. So basically, let's check whether these genetic variants that are supposed to cause prion disease are just as rare as prion disease is. I want to dispel a common misperception here. Prion diseases are not one in a million. You know, that's a common number that gets thrown around. One in a million is an estimate of the annual incidence of prion disease. So that's out of a million population, how many new cases of prion disease every year? Like, how many new people will get sick? But if you integrate that over a person's lifetime, or if you divide the number of prion disease deaths per year by the total number of deaths per year in the U.S. or any other country, you get a number that's closer to 1 in 10,000. And I actually think that that's still an underestimate. So, you know, a lot of cases get missed. I talked earlier about the diagnostic odyssey. If we hadn't agreed to an autopsy, my mother-in-law would never have been diagnosed. So there's definitely cases that we're missing. And in countries where they spend a lot more money and, you know, have a lot more referrals to their prion surveillance centers, they do end up finding more prion disease cases. And in those countries, they might see as many as, you know, 1 in 5,000 people dying of prion disease. So I think that that's probably a better estimate of how prevalent prion diseases really are. So let's suppose that prion disease all put together is 1 in 5,000. And, you know, as Brian mentioned earlier, you know, only 10 or 15% of those cases are genetic. Prion disease. Yeah.
Can I just interrupt for 1 second? That's 1 in 5,000 deaths per year are due to prion disease, right? Okay.
Yeah. So, and exactly. And, you know, and I think that you can also think of that as being lifetime risk, right? So if you just go out into the world and pluck a person off the street and then fast forward and ask, what are they eventually going to die of? 1 in 5,000 chance that the answer is prion disease. About 10 or 15% of cases are genetic. So genetic prion disease affects, you know, lifetime risk affects about 1 in 50,000 people. And there's a bunch of different genetic variants that cause genetic prion disease, right? Sonia's variant, for example, is only a minority of those cases. So you can figure that, you know, Sonia's exact subtype of the disease, you know, FFI, should be less than 1 in 100,000 people. So that means that if this genetic variant really always causes this disease, then this variant better not be found in any more than 1 in 100,000 people. Does that make sense? So we're basically saying, you know, if the disease is rare, the genetic variant should be just as rare. For a long time, this wasn't really a question that we could ask because we didn't have genetic data on enough people. And it's only been in the last few years, you know, we've been incredibly lucky that, A, you know, a ton more people have had their DNA sequenced. The price has dropped dramatically. You can get sequencing done for a few hundred dollars now. And a lot of people are doing it for research studies on all different diseases. And the second thing that's been really lucky is, you know, not only are people stepping up and being willing to donate their DNA to research, but the researchers who are doing those studies are turning around and offering to donate that data to other researchers to do other studies with it. So we were in a position basically where we were able to take, you know, DNA sequence data from tens of thousands of people that had originally been sequenced for, you know, for other purposes. So with respect to prion disease, they're pretty random, right? These are just, you know, pretty much random people you grab off the street. They shouldn't be selected for having neurodegeneration or anything. So we're kind of just looking at the population, and we're asking what genetic variation is out there. So the answers that we found is basically, you know, the answer depends on which mutation you have or which genetic variant you have. So unfortunately for my wife and for others, a lot of the variants that are best known in prion disease, so D178N, E200K, P102L, A117V, as far as we can tell, they really do cause a very high risk of prion disease. Now, it might not be 100%, you know, as I said earlier, it might be 90, 95%, but these are genetic variants where if you look at the scientific literature over the last 25 years, people have seen a lot of different families with the disease. Over and over again, we find that, you know, as soon as one person in the family has the disease, it's very likely that other people will develop it. And we found that those genetic variants are the most common among people, people diagnosed with prion disease. And those are the genetic variants that are rarest in the general population. So it really is the case that, you know, this super rare disease is really, you know, less than 1 in 100,000 people out there is carrying a variant that might cause it. So for my wife, this means she's at very high risk unless we develop a treatment or cure, which, you know, we would very much like to do. Now, the interesting finding was that there are other variants for which this doesn't quite seem to be the case. So there are some other variants out there, such as V210I, V180I, M232R, where, you know, no one has ever seen a really large family with 10 or 20 or 30 people with the same disease. Mostly what's been seen in the literature is one patient here, one patient there. You know, you see someone with prion disease who has this variant, but that person doesn't necessarily have a family history of prion disease, so it doesn't quite look like it's a genetic disease. And those are the variants that we found are actually present in control populations. So if you know, grab a person off the street, it's reasonably likely they might have one of those genetic variants. And so we used basically the difference in, you know, how common is this variant out there in the population versus how common is it among people with prion disease to estimate lifetime risk. And we found that there's a whole spectrum. So there's some genetic variants that give you maybe a 10% lifetime risk of developing prion disease. There's other variants that only cause a 1% lifetime risk, and then there's some that are really low, like a 0.1% lifetime risk. And then on the very extreme end, we also found that there are some variants that people that other researchers had previously thought caused prion disease. So they'd been seen in, you know, one or two patients with prion disease, and someone wrote a paper, put it in the scientific literature saying, we think this variant is a new cause of genetic prion disease. And when we looked, we found that some of these variants were actually found at about the same frequency in patients as they were in the general population. So an example of that is E196A is a genetic variant that's found in about 1 in every 500 Chinese people out in the general population, and it's also found in somewhere on the order of 1 in 500 Chinese prion disease patients. So, you know, it doesn't seem like this genetic variant causes prion disease. It's just that, you know, some people have this variant, and so by chance, some people with prion disease will have it too. So that was the main finding of the study, was simply that, you know, there's a real spectrum. You know, not all mutations are created equal. There are some variants that confer very little or no risk of prion disease, some that confer moderate risk, and some that confer a high risk. As sort of an aside to that, we also found, and this is a little bit complicated, but we also found three people who had a different type of genetic variant in their prion protein gene, which we call loss of function. So this is a genetic variant that is basically equivalent to deleting one copy of the gene. So you can think of this as kind of the opposite of prion disease. So, you know, genetic variants that cause prion disease make this mutant protein that does this horrible new thing that it shouldn't do. And if you're effectively deleting one copy of the gene, then you're just not producing any protein at all. And from the standpoint of prion disease, that would actually be a good thing. And there's been people out there researching, looking into ways to try to reduce the amount of prion protein that your brain produces as a way to, you know, prevent or delay or ameliorate prion disease. And we found people out there in the population who had genetic variants that sort of naturally did that. These people had a variant that made them produce, we think, less protein. And those people were healthy. So we view that as kind of a validation for that therapeutic strategy, that if we can find a way to reduce how much prion protein your brain produces, that would probably be safe. So yeah, those are pretty much the findings of the study. So I guess to reiterate, you know, what does this mean for people at risk of genetic prion disease? You know, I think unfortunately most people who are at risk are in the same position as Sonia is, in that they were originally told they're at high risk, and they really are at high risk. So I mentioned earlier, you know, D178N, E200K, some of the most common genetic variants that people with prion disease have really do seem to confer a pretty high risk of disease. Now, a minority of people who have previously been told that they're at high risk for genetic prion disease have different variants that we now think put them at only moderate or low risk of prion disease. So that's good news for them. And there's an even smaller minority of people who were previously told they're at high risk and we think may actually be at no particular risk at all. They might have a genetic variant that is actually completely benign and doesn't cause disease at all.
So going back from a personal perspective, you know, you with Sonia learning about the mutation, how do you think this knowledge will affect patients and their families?
Yeah, well, the thing is it's totally case dependent, right? So I think certainly for us, you know, even though we embarked on this whole study, you know, looking to find out are we sure that her variant is really high risk, we kind of thought that it probably was. And I think a lot of people, particularly if you have a long family history, you've kind of always assumed that you're at pretty high risk for this disease if you have the genetic variant. So I think for some people, you know, in terms of how you think about your risk, there's not a big change. For a minority of people, of course, it's great news. The thing that I think is really exciting for us is this idea of, you know, the handful of people out there who have genetic mutations that basically inactivate one copy of their gene. And I think that provides human genetic validation for what I view as a pretty promising therapeutic strategy. Obviously, putting that into practice, finding a way to do it in the brain is years away, but this is one brick in the wall. And I think given that our disease risk didn't change as a result of this study, that's the aspect that we look at as really, really promising and exciting for us.
Good. I mean, I know from a clinician side, if we get about one or two cases a year, we'll get the genetic results back that will be abnormal, and there's no family history, and unfortunately, we really have no idea what to tell the family. So these types of studies where we learn whether or not, number one, they're highly prevalent in the population, and number two, whether or not they're associated with other family members, I think is really helpful to those families and helping them kind of quantify how much risk they may be at or may not be at and whether or not they want to do like genetic testing on themselves and whatnot. So I think from that standpoint, from those family members, again, not a large amount, but it definitely has a dramatic impact on them. And I'm sure they're very thankful for your work. So what are your next steps in this project and in others?
So Sonia and I are, you know, we're still doing a little bit of work on the genetics. I think that there are things that we still need to do better. I think, you know, estimating what is the age of onset for these very high-risk variants is something I'm doing a little bit more work on. But for the most part, we have already made a transition from studying the genetics to focusing mostly on therapeutics. So, you know, day-to-day, we're actually in the wet lab. We're purifying protein. We're growing cells. We're screening chemical compounds with the goal of finding a treatment or cure for these diseases. You know, before Sonia gets sick, and I'm incredibly excited about that. It's just so energizing after 4 years of sort of studying and trying to figure out how to break into this field to actually be in a place where I feel like, you know, we're making a difference in finding treatments.
Great. Well, I would definitely say you've already made a difference on the field, and you're still young, so I expect that you'll be making a lot more differences later on. So I think we've been about a half hour into this, and I was wondering if we could stop recording, Debbie, and then open
yes,
it up.
Yes, we're all set. Yep. Thank you so much, Eric. That was outstanding, and you fit a lot into that half hour. So at this point, we're going to... No, that was wonderful. We're going to unmute the microphones now, and we're going to stop recording, and so we'll just pause for a second for that.